Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello and welcome back. Here we are again and we're back in my little chapel, surrounded by Christian icons, Judaic stuff, and statues of Sekhmet and statues of Isis for the divine feminine. And I love the Sekhmet story in Egypt. And she actually tells how the feminine can get seriously unbalanced in its node, because Sekhmet was the protector of Ra. Mm-hmm. She's the equivalent of Mars in the Greco-Roman pantheon. And humanity was disrespecting Ra, the sun god. So Sekhmet started going down and pointing this out to them. But she got a little bit over-enthusiastic and started raising them right, left and centre and shouting and destroying them. So Ra turned the river Nile into beer because she poured blood into it and was drinking the blood, and he turned it into beer to get her drunk. So they carried her off and she went to sleep. But so the thing about the ancient gods is they were very human. Mm. And we weren't expected to be perfection ourselves, because the gods weren't perfect themselves. And this is one of the difficulties we have in Christianity, which is we're presented with the perfect man and told we're stupid, ineffectual, not worthy to gather up the crumbs under his table.
Born evil,
yeah. So that's actually, Christianity has become the violent Sekhmet instead of the let's hold this balance, let's hold this strength. And I think you did want to talk about toxic femininity.
I really want to talk about toxic femininity, yeah. Apart from anything else, I'd love to know what you think it is. What is it in the feminine that's toxic?
Well, I'm just exploring it myself, so I will probably not know what I think until I hear the words I say, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I'll be delighted to go there with you.
Yeah, and we can pull this one backwards and forwards. But the most powerful toxic feminine we've got at the moment is the woundology, I think, which is the need to be identified by what is wrong, what has been done to you or not been done to you. The need to hold the resentment and the blame and to join in with other people on that. Mm. And it's terribly tricky, the fine line. All these things have this fine line, because pain, grief, chronic illness and all these things are horribly debilitating and upsetting and hurtful. And yet we have a choice whether we work on the healing of them, even if we can't ever get the physical body better, or we slide into the woundology, or the other toxic feminine, which is almost as dangerous, is the false positive. It's fine, I'm fine, I'll do more. And I was sat down this morning because I have to do some vicaring, counselling work, and both my dear husband and Adam said to me, "Oi, are you up for this? Up to this? You've been working very hard. You've had a lot of caring to do. There's a lot of difficult stuff to do. You know, you have to take care of Maggie first." And I sat there and thought, I've trained him well.
Yes! Well done, chaps. Yes.
Yeah. But that is so true. And the feminine doesn't do that. We have been trained to think that if we do everything for everybody else, we will be loved. We won't. We'll be despised and taken for granted.
Yeah, treated as the doormat we're acting like.
Yes. But if you act like the doormat, you will be. And that's why the powerful, powerful feminine is the gentle no. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do no, and I find no difficult too, I don't think so is really helpful.
Yes. Yeah.
Are you coming on Friday? I don't think so. Oh, but you must. Well, but I don't think so. I've not said no. I've said, I don't think so.
Yeah. And I'm inviting you to back right up there.
Yes. Yeah. And I love Stuart Wilde's teaching in his wonderful book. I can't remember what it's called now, but Stuart Wilde's early books were great. He went a bit David Icke towards the end, but so he went a little bit blamey and lizards. But he basically said, there is yes and there is no maybe. Because if it isn't yes now, right now it's no. And that's what we have to learn. I don't think so. Sounds like a maybe, but it isn't.
No, it's really not. It's a soft no, yeah.
And we actually have to watch these maybes, because maybes can be manipulated into, oh, but I thought you were coming. So the masculine in all of us is yes.
Yeah.
And the feminine in all of us is, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That can change. I want more. I want to sit with this. But right now, it's no. And the soft no, you see, sometimes you see pictures on the news of, and it's nearly always women, not always women, but it's men using the feminine in them, who stand like Gandhi did at the salt mines. You just stand. And if they hit you, you fall. But you just stand there and you love them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's been one of the most extraordinary repeated sights of the year for
yes.
me, is how many are now willing to do precisely that.
Yes.
Simply to stand in their no, quietly and gently, but not be moved.
Yes. And if you're picked up and moved, then you sit where they put you, think about it, and if you can, get up and walk back.
Yeah, extraordinary. Yes.
Yeah, and that really is the only way, because apart from anything else, if you get into the violence of it, you lose the integrity of your claim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So for me as well, part of the toxic feminine is the speed, or I don't know if that's the toxic feminine exactly, but the misaligned, actually probably in both feminine and masculine. Perhaps it's just the toxic 21st century, is that we have to do everything in a rush. We seem to believe not only must it be yes, but it must be yes now, or even better, yes yesterday.
Yes, the urgent is more important than the important.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
And that the in the toxic feminine who's lost her no and fallen into martyrdom and believes that yes must be the answer to kind of all the nurturing and yes. all the receptivity and all of those things that we associate with the feminine. Although, having said that, you know, nurturing is an activity. So in a way, nurturing is actually masculine.
Well, but feminine can be active. You see, it is this beautiful meld. It's a flow. It's the yin-yang. It keeps moving in and out. It's got the yin's got the eye of the yang, and the yang's got the eye of the yin. And so, in fact, the whole of the Kabbalistic teaching is don't do masculine, don't do feminine. Stand on the central column and be
in balance.
Be in balance.
Yeah.
We all have to be in balance because we've got the XX chromosome. We're probably 51%, 52% female, which is why we've manifested as women. And the men are probably 52, 54% masculine. But they've got all the feminine in them and we've got all the masculine in us. So it is always, where can we hold to the central column? And the central column in Kabbalah is consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is, of course, beyond gender and beyond the binary.
Yes, absolutely. And consciousness is using of the Kabbalistic tree of life, the soul triad is discernment and mercy, balanced with truth and beauty.
Mm.
So if you can actually say, all right, here is a situation, I need to apply discernment, loving kindness, truth, and the result will be beautiful. But what is the truth? Which truth? The truth, you know, the ultimate perennial truth, not just my truth.
Mm-hmm. Not just
it's
our truth.
Always, always balance. And, you know, there are many men in woundology.
I think it's really important to make sure that we're not talking about men and women.
No, we're not.
This is not gendered.
No.
That even to call it masculine and feminine in some ways is profoundly misleading.
Yes. Active receptive is probably
yeah,
slightly
active
better,
receptive
yeah.
is definitely better
yeah.
in my opinion. But that the reason I wanted to talk about the toxic feminine is actually just to bring some balance to the very loud conversation that's going on around toxic masculine.
Yes.
And that there's a toxicity in the whole of the system.
Mm.
And so And by its very nature, because there is no separation, and because we live in a you know, interwoven, interconnected field, and the way of something is the way of everything, that if there is toxic masculinity, then there will be toxic femininity.
There must be. Yeah. There must be, because the feminine has allowed it.
Well, and because those things exist in a balance. Yes. They are, as you say, either yes. side of the column of consciousness, yes. kind of thing.
But it has to start somewhere, and it usually starts somewhere in covetousness, which is the desire for more, rather than resting what is.
Okay.
I said that before I thought, so it may not be true.
I'm just, what immediately popped up for me was chicken and the egg.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I think the point I'm trying to make is that we have as women, we do have a huge responsibility to get our balance right.
Don't you think, as humans, we've got a huge responsibility yes. to get our balance
yes,
right?
Yes, but as you were saying, that all the yelling is at the patriarchy at the moment, and the yelling is still out of balance.
Yep.
Yes, that makes sense?
Yes, but why, as women, does Lion not have the same responsibility as you do to get this right?
Yes, he does, actually. Yes, he does. Yeah, I'll go with people. You're absolutely right. But I think I'm saying women because there's this sort of... I notice it when I talk with my mother or quite a lot of other women, that we will weave a pattern within us which is not our fault.
Mm-hmm. I would like to stand up and say, in the most gentle, compassionate, but quite loud voice, everything is born of woman.
Yes.
How is it not our fault?
Exactly. Thank you. That was exactly what I was trying to say, and you've said it much better. Yeah, everything is born of woman.
Yeah. And I'm not saying our fault.
No.
But it's most definitely not our fault.
Yes, it's definitely our responsibility. And no matter how... whether women have to go out and work now, which women do, you know, for the economics, because the economics rules this planet now, we are the ones who give birth to the children. So we have at least equal responsibility to raise those children to be in the balance.
Yeah. And that's where it becomes so incredibly fundamentally important to understand that it is not, oh God, what am I trying to say? So the presence of toxic or healthy masculinity and femininity as they are in the culture of the one raising the child, they're both there, whether there's a woman's body or a man's yes. body raising that child, whether there's one, two or many, they are all present in the field.
Yes.
And that it's so important to remember that we don't exist outside of our culture, and that in our culture they're toxic. So no matter how mended they are in us, because nothing exists in isolation, even if you are the most beautiful, balanced, glorious human being who's raised a beautiful, balanced child, that child is still going to be under the influence of the culture.
Yes.
And that, you know, that's where the conversation that I have with my sons around, we can't save the world one baked bean can at a time or whatever it is, you know, I totally agree with them, is that, you know, yes, we have to do our damnedest with the baked beans and with the babies and with all of it, but also we have to understand that it is not only my story that matters, it is our story and the story. Yes. And we must try our damnedest to change them too.
Yes, yes.
And that, to me, this is part of why I'm so up for these conversations, because maybe we can help unravel the story, because you can't change it, we as people, as Western, whatever we are, you know, just as human beings, on no matter where or what. We can't change the story, capital T, capital S, yeah. in which we live until we've kind of taken a step back from it, looked it squarely in the eye,
yes,
as it were, and gone, oh, there you are.
Yes.
I see you. And now I see that actually there's no happy ever after here, and I'd quite like one. So I'm going to get my pen out and start rewriting. But we can't do that unless we know, unless we see that we sit within that story.
Yeah.
And we are, at the moment, as a little, as a culture, we're the canary and the cage.
Yes.
And there are too many canaries who haven't seen the cage, haven't understood that they're singing from within the cage. And that somehow or other, we need to take the cage down. And so my kind of next question for the universe is, but I'm going to point it as you, because you're sitting in front of me and God knows if you've got any sort of an answer, but is how can we, and what can spirituality in general, Christianity in particular, any of them, offer the dismantling of one cage and the creating of a new beautiful place to be, perhaps that isn't a cage, and how are there stories from within all the stories that you know that can help us do this, or that can give us a place to stand while we take down one version of the story?
There are
and create
stories.
Another.
Those are the Old Testament stories of the heroines.
Okay, tell.
Have I told you the story of Esther?
Yes, but
Well, I'll just mention,
it bears repeating.
Yes, it bears repeating. The story of Esther is the Cinderella story after the marriage. She's a Jewish girl who is sort of in a lottery to marry the king of Persia, who needs a new wife. Mm-hmm. But the point of it is that there's a massacre planned for the Jews. And Mordecai, her uncle, sends her a letter saying, this is why you're queen of Persia. You have to now reveal that you're a Jewish, and you have to stop the king, who's been badly advised by his counsellors, and stop this massacre. Which is impossible, because the laws of the Medes and the Persians were unreversible. That was the basic law. If the king decreed something, it was irreversible. So Esther is stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm.
She's also fallen out with her husband, and she hasn't told him that she's Jewish. And so, but the story is so profoundly wise, because she says to Mordecai, very well then, give me 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you were talking about earlier, or on the previous recording, about not making it urgent.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed incredibly urgent, because the massacre was going to take place in 12 days' time, or 14 days' time.
Right.
But she said, to be able to do anything, I've got to get to me.
Yes.
And yes, I've lost
yes,
me.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't know how to be Queen of Persia. I don't know how to come into my own kingdom. I don't. Sorry, sovereignty. We went through that one again.
Yes.
I'm starting to learn that one. And I, it's always the so all that, like Hannah, she prays and then she accepts that it will be granted, or it won't.
Yeah.
And it is granted, and she gives birth to the prophet Samuel, and then she has more children later, and she's never cruel to the other wife either.
She gives birth to a prophet Samuel within 3 days?
No.
What happens within... I don't
no,
know
no,
this
no,
story.
No. I'm mixing
the
stories.
Days?
No, I'm mixing the story. With Esther, in the 3 days, she comes to herself,
mm-hmm.
into her own sovereignty, and she says, I have to go and stand before the king, and if I die, I die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the surrender, which is, this is my job to do. My little bit is to go to stand before the king and say, help me. So she has to overcome huge pride, because they've quarrelled. And that's another thing, which is one of our blockers, is pride.
Mm.
Jesus came to teach us humility. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who despise for you, use you and persecute you. That takes huge braveness and humility. Esther goes before the king, and the king is so delighted to see her that he stops the servants killing her and says, Queen Esther, what do you want? Because you can have it. And she says, come to dinner. And she invites her enemy to dinner. the one who's devised this whole Holocaust. And at the end of that evening, the king is so happy with the way the evening's gone, he says, what is your request of me? You can have it up to half my kingdom. And you and I would just go, save the people. But she doesn't. This is the power of the feminine no, because she knows it's not time yet. She's already taken 3 days. Mm-hmm. We're going into the fourth day. And she just goes, simply that you would have dinner with me again tomorrow night, my lord. Because she's not going to show him that she's a demanding bitch, frankly. You know, I invited you here for dinner so I could ask you my favour. No, I would like your company again tomorrow. And if it's right tomorrow, then I will ask. And she never has to ask, because in that extra 24 hours, the queen discovers that Haman, his advisor, has been deceiving him, and that everything he ever knew about his kingdom was wrong. So, you know, that time, that space, that womb.
Yeah.
That womb. And so the next night the king says to her a completely different thing, not what do you want, but Queen Esther, you can have anything up to half my kingdom if I may just have dinner with you again tomorrow. I mean, how beautiful is that?
Yeah.
And she says, I'm so sorry, my lord, but I can't. I have to go to my people and prepare to die.
Okay.
You know, he goes, what? And she says, I'm a Jew. We are sentenced to death. The laws of the Medes and the Persians are, you know, unreversible. Therefore, now I must go to my people. I'm sorry. I love you. I would have loved to have had dinner with you again, but my place is with my people. Can you see what a powerful no that is? Because she's not asking him to change anything.
Yeah.
She's just saying no.
Or not for her. She's not. I mean, yes. She's not asking him full stop, but yes. Especially she's not manipulating him.
No.
She's not asking him to do it for her. He's asking him to do it because it's right.
Yes. And he realizes, and it all gets turned around, because in the end, Haman is hanged, and the Mordecai is asked in, and they try to debate, what on earth can we do? What we cannot reverse this law. So they just send out a new law that says, yes, you are to massacre the Jews on this day. New law, the Jews are empowered to fight back, and the king's going to send weapons. So basically, everybody went, okay, we see what's happening here. He doesn't want the massacre, and it doesn't happen. But I just think that kind of story, and it's the same with the story of Deborah and Yael, and the story of Hannah, all the stories of the heroines, and the story of Ruth, is about the woman stating to God, I have to act now, help me. And listening and waiting. Every time it's the waiting. And this in our modern world we won't do.
Well, we won't listen either.
No. And we have to watch our box sets, all of them. They're crazy. You know, I'm going to watch something and I'm going to read another one and another one and another one and another one. And that's covetousness. I won't wait. I won't have the anticipation. I won't allow God time to sort. Jesus started his ministry with 40 days in the desert. 40 days to cleanse himself, to get going on what he had to do. We don't need to take 40 days, though 40 is one of the great, you know, we've got Lent, we've got Advent, we have all these 40. The first quarantine in the COVID-19 was 40 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, four fours is a cycle of completion. But if we're going to save our world, we have to do it with patience and listening.
Totally.
You know, dear God, we're sorry we fucked up. Please show me what I can do now, my part in this story.
Yeah. And well, for me, the taking the time to listen is absolutely fundamental. Yeah. And I find it very intriguing that the more desperate it becomes that we listen,
the more we don't.
Not just the more we don't, but the more extraordinarily exaggerated the opportunities to not listen become. You know, that it's not very long at all, really, since you couldn't possibly watch 10 episodes of whatever the hell it is back to back. And that the kind of polarity between our opportunities to distract ourselves and the necessity to not be distracted, but to be quiet, to be still, to listen, to just drop into the place of understanding that my animal body and my energetic and etheric and, you know, soul body, spirit body, all of those are indivisibly interwoven with all of the rest of life, and that part of my beingness is being in that in an aware way, and that the invitation to be unaware on every level is getting louder and louder and louder, and more pressing and becoming, so there's that whole, what's it called, FOMO thing. FOMO stands for fear of missing out. And that, you know, people will end up watching or going to or listening to or whatever. Absolute bollocks. Excuse me. Yeah. Just in case there's something good or it turned out to be really cool or, you know.
Which is why they have to check the news every hour. You know, once a day is more than enough.
I don't do news.
Good. I'm very glad. I mean, I worked in news for decades. And as soon as I came out of news, I don't think I've voluntarily read a newspaper since. Mm. I had to read every newspaper every day to collate stories.
Yeah. It's a stupid thing to say I don't do news. Of course I do news. You know, news is anything that you didn't know the minute before. But the...
Well, yeah, but that's real news. The news that we have on the TV and on the radio and in the newspapers is not that. It's North, East, West, South. It's gathering of information from all over the world. Very little of it is new because it's cyclical. Different people doing the same thing.
I'm sure I've said this before, but it definitely bears worth repeating. And if, dear listener, you happen to know who said it first, please let me know, because it's so spot on and so great. And that is... someone's very dry comment that when they were a younger person, as I once was, that you would witness the news in whatever way it was. You know, you watched it on telly, you heard it on the radio, you read it in the newspaper. And it would be information, and it was up to you to decide what you think about that information.
Oh, yes.
And now what you get is loads and loads and loads of opinion, and you have to decide whether or not you think it's true. And it's just...
Yes!
Holy hell!
You know, and you have your favourite columnists because they have the opinions that you agree with.
That you agree with, yes. Exactly. And you know, what actually, in the end, is the point of reading the newspapers, listening to the news, in inverted commas, or watching it on the telly? Because you have no guarantee whatsoever that it's real or true or accurate or... anything.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I actually think our nervous systems aren't designed to receive the news from north, east, south and west.
No.
North, east, west and south. And that part of all the ways in which we have become overstretched, overextended, desirous of putting our head into a box set and going kind of is because we're asking too much of ourselves, literally too much of the animal body, the body mind, because there's too much information. You know, we're not supposed to know what's happening on the other side.
No, and that's where we come to conspiracy theories. Oh, look at this very special information about how you're being controlled. Yes, you're being controlled by reading this information on how you're being controlled. It's just as controlling.
Yep.
Because it's designed to make you feel superior because you now know the conspiracy. And you can do the blame, and you'll go on finding more and more of it instead of sitting in contemplation. And right back to Christianity, early Christians, the Desert Fathers and the early Christians, all spent time in silence.
And I know that that's something that's incredibly important to both of us.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I can feel that if I go away and stay with somebody, I probably won't do my meditation or something. And I've been fairly stressed these last few weeks with caring for somebody and the dog's deaths and that kind of thing. And I went for a walk on the moor just a couple of days ago. And I went because I wanted to get out, wanted some me time. And I also wanted to walk one of the paths that I've walked with both the hounds without them for the first time, you know, and do the grieving that was appropriate for that. And I got halfway up the hill and she just said in my head, the goddess or whoever just said, just lie down, darling. You don't need to march.
Yeah.
They're not here, so lie down.
Yeah.
And I lay on my back on the moor and cried. And she just comforted me. She said, look at the beauty of these clouds. They're here for you and for everybody else. But right now, here for you. Yeah. And my body is supporting you. Your feet, you know, your shoes are off. Your arms are on the ground. Lift up your T-shirt. Let me carry you. You know, and I came home so refreshed.
Yeah.
So refreshed. And yet nowadays, earthing is an important thing with a lot of people who are spiritual. But do you know what they're doing? They're buying blankets off the internet which have the electrical pulse of the earth to sleep on.
Sorry.
I know. But if you haven't got land. And
well, also, what happens if you live three stories up in some building in a city?
Then you need
There's no lying on the blooming moor for you, is there?
No. So it's a good thing that you could get one of those things if you could afford it. But to put your bare feet on the ground is just so important and so healing. And I did it instinctively, mainly when I was 17. I nearly got into terrible trouble, even though America wasn't the way it is now then. I was flying to stay with some cousins in Arkansas, and we had to go via, I think it was Dallas. And it was the first international flight I'd ever done to America. And Joe and I, my friend, were absolutely knackered. I think we'd gone to St. Louis first and gone through the customs and had our tea bags stolen, taken away. We got to Dallas and I think we had a two-hour layover there. And there were some great big pot plants. And I took my shoes off and went and stood on them.
Great.
And I had no idea even why I was doing it. Of course, the security would be, oh, you can't do that. And I just said, I'm just standing on the bit of ground in Texas so I can say I've been to Texas. And they went, oh, that's all right then.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that. It was, I am tired, I am stressed, here is some earth.
Yeah.
Here is some earth. And even, no matter where you live, you could have a pot plant.
Totally.
And without understanding that we come from this planet and that we live on this planet, and the thing that, going back to Christianity again, is we don't take into account how they lived.
Yeah.
All these people live close to the land. All these people were barefoot or in sandals. All these people sat on the ground, were connected to the ground, understood the importance of the cycles. All the Jewish festivals are to do with the cycles of life. There's the new year for trees.
Mm.
You know, there's the tabernacles, the where you make a bower for yourself to live under. It's all connected with the land, and it's all connected with the life force, and it's all about this important thing of the Sabbath, of the festival of rest.
Mm.
6 days, you can go out and do it, and on the seventh day, listen, sit down, listen.
Yeah.
And what we're doing now, on our foreign holidays, maybe a little less of it this year because people haven't been going abroad so much.
Is this the royal we?
Probably, yes.
Yes.
But I have done it and I've observed other people do it. We go on holidays and we lie on a plastic couch on concrete by a swimming pool.
Yeah. Okay.
The whole point was to go and lie on the beach. The whole point was to be in the sea. Not in the chlorinated water, but to be in the natural salt of the water and with bare feet on the beach, playing with your buckets and spades, that kind of thing. And we're not even giving ourselves that grace.
Yeah.
Rant well, over.
No, I mean, yeah. We live on a tiny little island. The furthest you can get away from the beach is, I think it's Oxford, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's the furthest you can be from the beach, which is still only, I don't know how long it is, but it can't be more than about three and a half hours or something, to the beach from Oxford. So, it's all very extraordinary, isn't it? This desire to be elsewhere. And I immediately have forgotten the point I was going
well, that's okay.
to try
you,
and make
you,
with that.
But you think on your point, but I'm just going to say, is there anything practical that we can suggest that people do just to move one inch towards
Oh, so many things. So absolutely, the first one being, no matter how high in the air and how encased by concrete you are, is that there is still nature everywhere around you. The very air you breathe is nature. The water you drink, no matter how many cycles it's been through of chlorination or whatever, is still water, you know.
The fluid of life.
Yes. The fluid of life, exactly. And that, most importantly perhaps, every tree you pass, every dandelion in the crack of the pavement, and every cloud, every bird, every breath of wind, they are still there, still present, even amongst the concrete. And that to have the fundamental understanding that she, that voice, that one who said to you, stop walking, lie down, these clouds are for you. They are there for all of us. And it's something that we have, as a culture in the West, we seem to have missed out on totally, is the knowing that, yeah, we love it, her, them, it, they, us, we, loves us right back, is love. And so when, you know, when you look at the cloud and your little face looks up at it, it's looking down at you. And as you offer up your heart in gratitude because it's bringing you rain and you're Californian, or it's just there and you're grateful to be alive, it is loving you back. Yes. And to remember that we are in a relationship of reciprocity with all of the rest of life, the visible and the invisible, is so, so, so important.
Yes.
And then on top of that, you know, go, go, lie on the ground, kiss a tree, hug a sunflower, whatever, you know.
When I was up in Aylesbury with our friend, which is a very built-up town, and I went for a walk, and I found that there was a pathway. Most places there is a pathway, a green pathway, and I walked the green on the green pathway. And at my feet, I saw an apple, and there was a wild apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
And it was absolutely beautiful apple. And I said, may I? And they said, yes. And I picked it up and took a few bites out of it, the side that hadn't been wormed, but that's fine. It was lovely. And I just suddenly thought, well, what else is here?
Mm-hmm.
And I got a scarf, I hadn't got a bag or anything, but I looked at all the trees and there were elderberries everywhere and they were begging me.
Yes.
They were begging me to take some.
Yeah.
And then there were hawthorns, scarlet hawthorns, and they weren't ready in Devon. And rose hips.
Mm.
You know, and blackberries, of course. And I'm just walking along.
You've got all the makings of a fabulous hedgerow jelly.
Exactly. And there was plantain and I couldn't see any self-heal, but when I got back to Adam's house, I went and looked in the garden, and there it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I just said to him, well, the good news is, Adam, that if the zombie apocalypse comes, we could probably forage. But you know, this idea of just seeing how just as I was doing that walking, the universe was saying, look, here's my abundance. Nobody here wants it. Will you have some?
Yeah.
What a gift.
What a gift. Yeah. And I so get that sense of those things which offer fruit really so wanting us to take some of the fruit, to accept the generosity that's being offered.
Oh, yes, we're running out of time, but I just want to make one closing point, which we might take up on the next time. When I go back to the story of the Garden of Eden, this whole idea of God saying you can't eat from this tree, I have a strong suspicion, I have no evidence of this, and we know Genesis was rewritten.
Mm-hmm.
We know it was patriarchalized, if that's a word.
It is now.
I wonder if it was nothing to do with any external God, but whether the tree said, you may not gather from me right now. And humanity said, I want. And that's the story of where we are now.
Oh my God, it is. That is the story of where we are now. And that makes perfect sense of the whole story. Oh, yes. Oh, I've got such a big yes to that. I really think that that's my story now. That's
yes.
Hey, I asked you, what is the story that can help us find our way between the worlds of the cage and out of the cage. Yes. And I think you just hit on it. So you just so have. Mm. That's utterly wonderful, Maggie. What a gift. Thank you. Really, sincerely. What an extraordinary gift.
And I've been meaning to say that for the last four episodes, and it hasn't come out at all. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you. We'll see you next week.